common. Just a few.
How many plays have you done over the years?
Oh, many. Many, many, many.
Would you do another one? Should we do a play? And put it up somewhere and do it as like a fundraiser someday?
That'd be great.
Moving Wisconsin forward, one joke at a time. This is Kristen Bry with As Goes Wisconsin.
Yada, yada, yada.
Hello, Wisconsin. Welcome to the lunch hour of As Goes Wisconsin. We are so excited, and we're going to get right to the interview because our next guest is actually a very old friend of mine. I think we've known each other for 10 years-ish back in San Francisco.
I think it's been 10, yeah.
Has it been around 10? And so we lived in San Francisco at the same time. We lived in New York at the same time. Now she is based in Portland, Oregon, and she is a journalist. Rebecca Grant is a journalist and author who has been covering reproductive rights for the better part of the last decade, and she's written for everyone. New York Magazine, Mother Jones, Marie Claire, Vice. And she is here to talk about her new book, Birth, Three Mothers, 9 Months, and Pregnancy in America. But before we get into that, you got some news this week.
Yes, I did.
So we were very proud of our WBA third place best interview. But you, my friend, worked on an episode of This American Life last year. And you found out this week that that episode won a Peabody.
Yes. It was actually the first like audio piece of journalism I've ever done in a formal way. And so to have it be with This American Life, which was an incredible honor, and then to have that episode win an award is just like pretty, I'm still kind of processing and wrapping my head around it. It's super exciting.
So what was the episode about?
So the episode was a full hour dedicated to the overturning of Roe v. Wade, basically. So the team started planning and working on the episode even before the decision came out. I don't know exactly when they started, but their plan basically was that it was anticipated that the decision was going to come out sometime in June of 2022. And so they had kind of stories and the episode mapped out and reporters in place so that the week after the decision, they could go live with this episode. And so there was this wonderful reporter and documentarian named Maisie Crow, who she was sort of embedded at Jackson Women's Health Organization, which was the clinic, the abortion clinic in Mississippi that was at the center of the case. And then, you know, there were a few of us other reporters. And so I got pulled in because I did a story for New York Magazine last year that was about where to access the abortion or medication abortion in all 50 states, even if you live in a state where abortion would come to be banned. And so as part of that story, I interviewed an anonymous source who was sort of shipping people abortion pills outside of official legal channels. And so that source is sort of what led me to This American Life, where I did a story with a producer, a great producer named Aviva, kind of about this, we called her the pill smuggler. And so, yeah, it was part of this like broader segment that also included the official abortion clinic, included some people who were sort of on the other side of things, like, you know, preparing for all these new babies that were going to be born. So, yeah, it was really fun. And I still can't believe that it went on to win this award. I mean, I can. It was a great episode. But
and so, like, what is that? What did you just introduce yourself as that now? Like, hi, Rebecca Grant, Peabody winner.
No. Only when my husband wants me to do something I don't want to do. And I'm like, you can't ask me to take out the trash because, you know. Some of us have contributed to a Peabody award-winning episode.
That's wonderful. I don't have a Peabody, Rebecca, but I'm going to use that excuse.
Yes. So I guess before we get into the book, give us a bigger picture of your work. Because like I've known this as your friend as far as the different stories you've covered. And this has become the story of the last year, right? Up until Roe getting overturned. I think there was a lot of us who knew that it was coming or expected that it was coming. There was a lot of women who do not live and breathe politics or follow this stuff. And so they were really blindsided. And we've seen the after effect of how angry they are about it in elections. And we've seen so many pieces have happened in the last year. But you started working on this and this topic of reproductive rights, of pregnancy, of abortion, of so many and so many different angles of it. I mean, what year did you start kind of narrowing in on this reproductive rights as being your main beat?
Yeah, because Kristen, when you and I met, I was still working at VentureBeat, which was like a tech news site, you know, doing that thing in San Francisco. And it was really when I struck out on my own as a freelancer. So that was around, really it was the end of 2014, but like, let's just say 2015. And I became a full-time freelancer. And I had this realization that I could write about whatever I wanted. And I could write about things that I really cared about, which, you know, as sort of in the first part of my journalism career, you're just so happy to have and thankful to have a job in the first place. And so I was sort of an unlikely tech reporter. Like I didn't even have a Twitter account or iPhone when I got a job at a tech news site. So, you know, that was a bit of a learning curve. So becoming a freelancer, becoming self-employed was kind of my chance. And reproductive rights has always been something I've cared deeply about. Like my mom brought me to feminist marches growing up. And so I started in 2015 as my, having that as my beat. And I remember at the time, people would sort of say like, I can't believe that's enough for its own beat. Like it was not on the radar, kind of in the, on the mainstream consciousness. I don't think in the same way that now nobody, I mean, of course, like everywhere needs a reproductive rights reporter. And so when Trump got elected in 2016, and so much of the discourse around his election was what's going to happen with the Supreme Court, and, you know, what's, because he was saying all of these really sort of hostile, vitriolic things about abortion rights, specifically to kind of drum up support. And so I was in this position of having been sort of one of, I think, maybe a handful of people, it's fair to say probably more than that, but like who were already reporting on that issue as a beat. And so, you know, I just sort of was able to continue to write these stories. And as I was reporting predominantly on abortion rights, I was exposed to other aspects of kind of reproductive healthcare more broadly. Like, you know, I would interview a source who would then tell me about something that had to do with maternal healthcare. And so the more that I started reporting on people in the reproductive justice movement and like learning about their work, the more that my kind of scope expanded. Like I always said reproductive rights, but what I really meant was abortion. But then it really started to expand to encompass all of these other things, which of course included maternal healthcare, which was ended up being the subject of my first book.
We're talking to Rebecca Grant, who is a journalist and author, and her new book is called Birth, Three Mothers, 9 Months, and Pregnancy in America. And I think that's an important, what you just said, even the switch that happened for you is that reproductive rights is bigger than just access to abortion. And it's like options in how you have your baby, which I think is a lot of what this book is ends up being about, is birthing centers, midwifery, being hospitals, like the impact that doctors and lawyers have had on how we have babies. And so I guess knowing where you were, you came from, of it started as talking about abortion and like the chipping away of that and the access to that. But then what was it that kind of inspired you to have your first book? This is your first book, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Have your first book be more so about birth.
I think it was a couple of things, but maybe foremost was that as I was, you know, doing this reporting, like I was just talking about, I really came to see very clearly and learning from people that I interviewed how all of the issues that really brought me to care about abortion rights, bodily autonomy, human rights, agency, and sort of control over not just your reproductive life, but just sort of your life overall and the ways that those things are related, civil liberties, like all that stuff was just as true for maternal health care as it was for abortion rights. But at least in kind of the mainstream media, I wasn't really seeing that many people who were looking at it that way, who were looking at how you're treated when you give birth, what happens to you when you give birth, where you give birth as like a reproductive rights or a feminist issue as sort of intrinsically related to that impulse towards bodily autonomy that we is sort of very familiar to talk about with abortion. And so it felt like it was more of an open field in some ways. There were so many people, you know, after Trump who got elected who started covering abortion, and I was still doing that, but I was finding there were so many stories over maternal health care that just kind of weren't really being told in the same way. And I did this big story in 2018 that was about women in Alabama who were traveling out of state to give birth with midwives. And I was just fascinated by this of like, why can't you give birth with a midwife in your own state? Also, why do you care so much about midwifery that you're like renting a cottage over a state line and driving there to give birth? And so that sort of interest in like what people's options and access looks like and why they make the decisions that they do was really what sort of set the foundation for the book, and why, even though it is meant to be general in the sense of like, I'm following three first-time mothers to learn about their experiences in this very intimate, closely reported way of like, how are you feeling with your nausea today? And, you know, like, do you feel like your boobs are like whatever, the sort of like intimate, sensitive questions. It was also always from the beginning going to be focused on midwives and birth centers, because even though I was wanting to look at the maternal healthcare system more broadly and some of the problems within it and the challenges, I really also kind of wanted to look at this really unique and fascinating subculture that has a fascinating history and that people don't know as much about as sort of the entry point.
And it's funny because we don't have to stick on this, but I'm assuming that you, that the midwifery thing's so interesting to me, and like the fact that people were having to leave Alabama because that's what they wanted. Because it reminds me of that story that happened a couple in April of the family whose baby got taken away because they had like a midwife deliver their baby at home. And was it jaundice or what did they get reported on that they then the CPS came and like took the kid?
Yeah, I believe it was a jaundice issue, which is like super normal and happens all of the time. There's a huge amount of stigma against midwives and against families who pursue out of hospital birth. And, you know, one of the things that I talk about in the book is the ways in which to make out of hospital birth as accessible and as safe as possible, integration with the mainstream healthcare system is really important. Like there's all of this research and studies that shows that. And so when you have the sort of level of antagonism or skepticism between organizations like, you know, hospital organizations or like child protective services type groups, and this idea of out of hospital birth as being kind of reckless, then those are the kinds of stories that you get. And of course, in that case too, it was racism, because it's like, who is given the benefit of the doubt in terms of their parenting decisions?
Absolutely. All right. Well, Rebecca Grant will still be here when we come back. We're going to dive more into what is in her book and what the research and the reporting looked like. Stick with us. This is As Goes Wisconsin.
You are listening to As Goes Wisconsin, a product of Civic Media. Enjoy it live across Wisconsin, Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. until 2 p.m. Find your local station on our website, civicmedia.us, or on the Civic Media app, and catch any of your favorite shows as a podcast wherever you listen.
Online.
My baby don't care. My baby don't care for shows. My baby cares for me.
Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin. I am Kristen Bry. She is Jane Matinere. And we are talking to Rebecca Grant, journalist and author of the new book, Birth, Three Mothers, 9 Months, and Pregnancy in America, which is now available from Avid Reader Press. And we will link it to the show notes for today on asgoeswisconsin.com/listen. So I guess in knowing kind of the journey of like, you wanted to do a book about maternal health, and knowing that kind of the untold stories that were happening there, how did you go about deciding to do it? Because this is one birthing center, three women, but all in Portland. And so kind of the decisions as far as you had the bigger idea for the book, doing it in multiple cities versus one city, like choosing who you wanted. Like obviously, they had to be consenting women who wanted to be part of it. But as far as like setting up how you were going to approach like what is a very big topic, how did you go about that?
When I was first developing the proposal and the idea and talking with, my agent, talking with my editor about it, one of my initial impulses was actually, what if I follow people in different cities? Or what if I follow one home birth person, one birth center person, and one hospital birth person? Like, those are just sort of some of the ideas I was kicking around. And so how I sort of landed on the approach that I did, there were a couple of reasons. I mean, one, honestly, was COVID, because I reported the book, I started reporting in 2020 before the vaccines were coming out. And so it just wasn't like I was going to be traveling all of the time to report. But also, and maybe more importantly, I felt like there would be a greater cohesion to the book if there was a shared sense of place and setting. So I love the idea of being able to kind of embed in a birth center and be able to observe the midwives as they went about their day-to-day lives in order to sort of tell the history of how that birth center came about, tell the history, a little bit of like the building itself. I just sort of felt like that would create the sense of unity and cohesion rather than just three completely separate stories that were sort of being smushed together because the mothers shared the fact that, like, I found them, I guess, in common. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I live in Portland. So of course I was looking at birth centers in Portland. And Andalouse, which is the birth center where the book really focuses, was at the time the busiest birth center in the state. And it had been around in its first building since the late 90s. And so it sort of was very well established in the community, and they were busy. And of course, as you touched on, one of the other big pillars was being able to have the reporting access that I needed. And the midwives, the birth center's founder, a midwife named Jennifer Gallardo, she was just immediately on board with the project. Like, I honestly expected to have to make a little bit more of a pitch, but she kind of pretty quickly got it and was excited about the idea and supportive and sort of said, like, yeah, have at it. Whatever my midwives who are working at the birth center are comfortable with, and of course, whatever their clients are comfortable with, like, that's fine. Like, you know, I didn't need to ask her permission to go into the birth center or anything like that. And so having that level of sort of trust and access was really important. And so I found my three characters. The first one, Jillian, she was actually the birth center's office manager and the front desk person. And she had gone to midwifery school, done her training at Andalouse, and then she became their office manager before taking her midwifery test. And so she was pregnant with her first child, working at Andalouse, and planning a home birth. And so that just kind of ticked so many boxes for me, because I knew that it would be a way to explore some about what it means to be a midwife today and how you become one, as well as the history through her story. And her story was a sort of portal into the day-to-day life of Andalouse, because she was helping to manage it. And she was having a home birth. And so that kind of idea I touched on before of, like, maybe showing birth across environments, I could kind of do that in a way that still felt cohesive. And then Jillian introduced me and connected me with a number of the birth center's clients who might be interested in talking, who were also first-time mothers. And so that was what led me to Tanika, my second character, who was actually a nurse, an aspiring labor and delivery nurse who was giving birth at Andalouse. And I was drawn to her story for a number of reasons, but one of them was that the fact that she was a nurse who wanted to work in a hospital birth setting, but for her own birth wanted to give birth in a birth center, I found that really interesting. And I thought there was a lot to explore there. And then my third character, Allison, was a little bit of an outlier, because she didn't really think of herself as, like, a birth center or midwife person, but she'd had a traumatic miscarriage experience where she felt pretty disaffected with the kind of mainstream hospital care she received. And that led her down this journey. And I liked the idea that the reader could kind of follow her journey with her if they weren't someone who was well acquainted with midwives or birth centers. And so through these three characters, even though they're highly idiosyncratic, specific individuals, I was also able to address all of these larger themes in the book that were really important to me, like history, as I've mentioned, like the U.S.'s sky-high rates of maternal mortality, like the just the sort of ballooning costs of our maternal health care. So all of those larger contextual things are really woven with those individual narratives.
And so I guess, because we could probably talk about this for a lot longer than we have you in the minute and a half that we have back, or we have left, what is, like, the big takeaway or the thesis that you hope readers get out of the book?
I think that it was really important to me in the book that I wasn't saying You know, I think that everyone should give birth outside of a hospital. Everyone should give birth with a midwife. You know, people shouldn't have medication or something when they're giving birth. Like, I don't believe any of those things. I think midwifery is an incredible option for people who are eligible, which, you know, usually means people who are having a low risk pregnancy. And it should be a more mainstream part of our healthcare system. And there's a ton of research to back that up. But there are all these reasons why that's not the case. One of which is access. You know, it's sort of like what we talk about with abortion. You know, just because you have the right to an abortion, does that mean you can get to a clinic? That's kind of true in some ways with birth centers and midwifery. So it's really this idea that everyone should have access to a range of options that best fit them and sort of best fit their needs. And that the mainstream kind of idea of going to give birth in the hospital that at least certainly I was raised with is not necessarily like the be all end all sort of best approach. And so I think it's just trying to challenge our thinking of sort of what is normal and what we should accept as normal.
Well, I can't wait to read it. And so I'm so happy that we got you on the show. I'm so happy to see your face and talk to you. Rebecca Grant is a journalist and author who's been covering reproductive rights since 2015. And her new book is called Birth, Three Mothers, 9 Months, and Pregnancy in America. We will link her Peabody Award-winning episode of This American Life and the book on today's show notes. It's so good to see you, friend.
So good to see you. Thanks for having me.
Have a great day. All right. When we come back, CJ Safer will be here to answer the question, what does Wisconsin want? This is As Goes Wisconsin. Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin. I am Kristen Bry. She is Jane Matt-Nair. And we are going to jump right into it because I already know we're not going to have enough time to talk about all the things we want to talk about. But CJ Safer, president of Institute for Reforming Government, is back because they published a pretty massive report and a massive undertaking of the last year of going to 25 cities across Wisconsin, 42 listening sessions, 5,300 miles across Wisconsin to listen. Basically, and listen to different people about in Wisconsin about what they want. So how is that as like a whole? What word would you sum that up with, CJ?
Incredible, tiring, and enlightening.
Okay.
And obviously, a lot of credit goes to my colleague, Madison Hartman, who managed the project. In 2006, former Speaker of the Florida Assembly, Marco Rubio, before everyone tunes out,
little
wait,
Marco.
Wait. So Rubio, when he was Speaker of Florida, he drove around the entire state of Florida and held all these listening sessions. And he just wanted to hear from the people of what they thought Florida should do.
Yeah.
So we read that book and we had a similar idea of, let's go around Wisconsin. Let's talk to school board members in rural and urban areas. Let's talk to small businesses, manufacturers, farmers, and let's actually figure out, you know, let's not tell them what we think that they should do, but actually let's sit down and listen and learn. So what we did, we had one simple rule. We just listened. We asked a basic question, which was, what problems do you have? And what policies or what solutions do you have for the state of Wisconsin? And it was absolutely amazing to actually just go around and listen to people. And you would just be surprised across the party, you know, from Democrats to Republicans to independents. People just want to be heard because the biggest takeaway that we had is Wisconsin has a significant amount of problems and we have such a gorgeous state. We have so many natural resources, a lot of potential, a lot of things going for us. But we have a lot of real problems from mental health, drugs and opioids, taxes and regulations and bureaucracy, and just real frustrations with the status quo that really goes beyond partisan divide, that goes beyond occupation, that really transcends wherever you are in the entire state.
And so because I want to get into kind of the biggest issues that you heard across the different groups, but also just kind of like what kept coming up. But I guess, how did you find, like, was it like how when they did a major league and they needed all those extras in Milwaukee and they just put like flyers up? Or like, how did you find the people that you ended up talking to?
Well, the first rule of thumb is to hire a rock star person, and that's what I did with Madison Hartman. And Madison was able to really just fill rooms with people, just honestly just going through our network, but also just cold calling. Like, we don't know a lot of farmers in southwestern Wisconsin.
Yeah.
We don't know a lot of people in Arcadia. So we actually just had to force ourselves to get outside of our comfort zone. And then a lot of it was just kind of figuring out, like, who did we want to hear from? We can't talk to everyone. That's why there was a poll that was done, that the findings, a morning consult poll that was released a few weeks ago. We can talk about that. But really, it was just kind of going outside of our comfort zone. And you would be surprised going into northeastern Wisconsin, going and talking to school board members and principals, and people just, again, want to be heard. And, one of the stories that I'll never forget is sitting down in one of the most rural school districts in Wisconsin. And there was a fifth grade teacher, and we were asking the fifth grade teacher, you know, what are the problems you have? How can, you know, what policies are there to improve it? And she responded and she said, you know, there's a lot of these discussions on funding and school choice and, you know, the things that get the headlines. She said, one out of every three kids in her class in fifth grade was inflicting self-harm last year.
What?
One out of every three kids in her class was inflicting self-harm. When you think about that, those are 10-year-old boys and girls who come from broken homes. The drug crisis has just ravaged this county in northeastern Wisconsin. And they're coming off of COVID, school shutdowns, school closures, but just a general, just whatever you think, just a disruptor of life, like the loneliness. And the school district, and I think in my experience, it was common all throughout rural Wisconsin, was they're hiring mental health practitioners. And we're now asking, like, school districts, if you just think of where we've gone from the last 5, 10, 15, 20 years, we're asking so much of teachers, so much of school districts. And when I heard that story and I heard that, like, well, the district feels like they're the ones that has to step in and they're hiring mental health practitioners because there isn't enough mental health treatment in northeastern Wisconsin. It really kind of thinks of you of like the kitchen table issues, especially the things that get the headlines, aren't necessarily the things that are keeping teachers, school board members, and a lot of parents and family like members up at night in certain parts of the state.
So I guess that's kind of a good segue into what feels, because there's a lot of different ways to cut the data. You can look at this by farmers versus manufacturers versus retailers and what people do. You can look at different regions, but you can also look at it like, what are the big things that across the board came up again and again and again? And it seems like big one was mental health. And also like health and healthcare in general, right?
Healthcare in general. College students, we sat down with a number of college students and they had the similar mental health issues. They were citing a study, I think it was done by University of Wisconsin, that showed that over 50% of UW students have reported having some sort of anxiety in the past year, about 60 to 70% for girls. I thought that number was incredibly high. I mean, think that these issues are there in college, but all these like students thought they thought that number might have been under. I mean, it's just how mental health issues in college are now kind of the norm and it's just kind of accepted. But one thing in like education, something that we've discussed in the past is reading and literacy issues. We sat down with a group of teachers in Kenosha. And this was something that kept coming up. They were eighth grade teachers, and their frustration was that they're being now charged with, they're evaluated based on how kids read, but they're being sent these kids into the system that don't know how to read. Because of something we've discussed in the past, Wisconsin continues to elevate kids throughout the system. And once you can't read by first or second grade, you're not learning in fourth grade. You're not learning in fifth grade. You're pretty much lost in like the system. And a lot of frustration actually from teachers that they thought that they were being unfairly treated because of Wisconsin's literacy problems.
So that the teachers were getting blamed For the literacy problems?
When you're in like eighth grade, like when you're an eighth grade teacher and there's all these students that you're having, that you're getting, who aren't equipped for eighth grade for reading issues, for math, they don't know how or why they're supposed to like educate those students because they're already 2-3 years behind.
We're talking to CJ Safer, president of Institute for Reforming Government, about their new report that came out this week, What Wisconsin Wants. And we will link that because it is there's a lot there. We're certainly not going to be able to touch on all of it simply in the half hour for today. But I guess other things that came out of schools, I mean, obviously, I would imagine maybe teacher shortage or and did it differ at all? Because you in the report, you separated out public school administration and teachers, and then charter school administration and teachers. And so what was kind of the overlap versus the different problems that you heard from each group?
Well, look, teaching, and this week is National Teacher Appreciation Week.
We know. We've been covering that.
You know, teachers are the backbone of our K-12 education system. And it was actually kind of interesting. We did tour one of the most successful charter schools by like the ratings out in Beloit Lincoln Academy, and they have the teaching shortage is an issue there. Teacher shortage was an issue of the schools that we toured in rural Wisconsin. Teacher shortage was an issue that we hear in Milwaukee, and like this is something that is holding back every single sector. Whether you're you believe in school choice, this holds back private schools. If you believe, if you're in rural Wisconsin or Milwaukee or the Wow counties, like this is an issue that's everywhere. Mm-hmm. And I know we've touched on this in the past with what are the solutions. But as far as this needs to be accepted as just one of this general bedrock problems in K-12 education, and until we fix it, it doesn't seem like that's something that's going to be advancing. You know, we're not going to be able to advance our K-12 system.
And so healthcare, mental health, schools, what were some of the other big things that felt universal, or at least universal for Wisconsin?
Well, there was certainly to quickly tie up the education sense, a little bit of a frustration with just, and I use this term for, people can use whatever term they want, but just bureaucracy, right? Like, why do we have to go to DPI to hire, there's districts and some of them, they don't want their names out there for various reasons, mm-hmm. but there's districts that we've talked to who want to help with the teacher shortage, go into the trades and bring in someone who, is an expert in culinary arts or an expert in engineering and bring them in to teach. And there's just a frustration of just bureaucracy, right? Like you got to go to the DPI for a special approval. The laws aren't really perfect to help you. They don't give districts a lot of control. Teachers don't have a lot of control over their classroom. But I would be remiss if we didn't, if I didn't talk about the workforce issues. We did talk to a number of manufacturers, various parts of the state. We toured Waupaca Foundry, which is one of the largest iron castings, one of the largest iron foundries in the entire country. And they cannot expand without more workers, just blue collared workers that are going to actually want to work in a foundry. And that is something, especially ones that are in Waupaca. But businesses like that, that's kind of the bedrock of our economy. Manufacturing is still incredibly big. Mm-hmm. And look, we've talked about the worker shortage issue a number of ways. There's a number of different ways of talking about it. It's multifaceted. But when you actually tour some of these businesses and you actually see that there are lines and that there's machines that are just sitting idle because there's not enough people to work them, then it really just sets in you that there's just limits of what we can achieve without getting more workers into the Wisconsin economy.
And so I guess with that, that was manufacturing. And so in the different industries that you talked to, were any of them not feeling the pinch of?
We didn't talk to a single business in any part of the state that didn't feel like they were having pinched. We toured Johnson Timber, which is one of the biggest employers in Sawyer County in the North Woods, the lumber industry. They explained to us that before COVID, they would get about 8 job applications for every opening that they had. 8 job applications for every opening that they had. Now they get about one or two. And, you know, their frustration and others that we heard is like, you know, they feel like they, the Department of Workforce Development was not, you know, was too lenient on people that were just, you know, ghosting for job applications. But just generally speaking, there's not just not enough people applying for open positions. And then you get the question of like, well, how many people are even going to go to the Northwoods to begin with?
Yeah.
So that's really symbolic of what we heard. Taxes, especially from small businesses and entrepreneurs. How can we get Wisconsin or even the Milwaukee area to be more accommodating for entrepreneurs to kind of have the regulatory scheme be less one size fits all and more accommodating to people that are willing to take on a ton of risk and risk a lot of money? We heard that when we met with some startups.
All right. Well, we're going to take our first break, but when we come back, we will continue talking about what does Wisconsin want with CJ Safer from Institute for Reforming Government. This is As Goes Wisconsin. Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin. I am Kristen Bry. She is Jane Matinere, and we are talking to CJ Safer of Institute for Reforming Government about their big report that they put out this week after 25 cities, 42 listening sessions, talking to people all across from Wisconsin about what problems they see, what solutions they would like to see. But similarly, you forwarded me a survey that came out this this week from State Policy Network. And that has some interesting top lines, too, as far as like what people care about. And I think I'd love for you to go over some of the what you interpreted from their survey. But also, I think that there's something interesting with all of this as far as like what politicians talk about. What do we talk about is like the media, and then what you're like, what people are actually caring about and where is the overlap and where is like the like stark misses.
Yeah. And so when we did our, you know, our listening sessions or ideas raisers all throughout the state, you know, we're very clear that, you know, what we're doing is just trying to get into communities to listen. Last couple of weeks ago, there was a poll done, margin of error of like 3 of Wisconsin voters by Morning Consult that really just kind of dug deep into kitchen table issues, which just asked about a policy problem and said, is this a problem, a significant problem, or somewhat of a problem to you and your family. And I thought the numbers were astonishing because we're getting high numbers for some of this.
Like super high.
Like super high. Like things where it's like you'd only expect like, you know, is it time for Aaron Rodgers to move on? Like like that's like the kind of like harmony.
So she's got jokes.
But when you have like 89% of the state, 89% of voters that say that drugs and addiction are a problem in Wisconsin, to me, that's astonishingly high. I mean, when you're looking at a scientific poll that's done and, you know, tries to represent and sample the entire state, 85% of voters said that the cost of healthcare is a problem. 83% of voters said mental health is an issue. 80% said cost of childcare is an issue. 75% said middle class tax rates are an issue. And there's like 69% said childcare is an issue too. So when you
like
look
access
at access to. So when you look at some issues that got about 70% or more of the state says that they're an issue. 7 of every 10 people in the state, according to this poll, say it's a problem. Drugs, cost of health care, mental health, cost of child care, access to child care, middle class tax rates. I mean, you're really seeing that these are kind of the things that people think are holding back their families and the state. And I think it's absolutely, I mean, one, it's terribly concerning because I think those are all really challenging problems. And I also think that it's something that's a bit of a wake-up call for policymakers and organizations such as IRG of like, we need to be focused on fixing what ails Wisconsin because some of these things are really big problems.
I just want to make sure a vast majority of Wisconsinites, I assume, did not agree that the wealthiest people in Wisconsin are struggling and should get a tax cut. Did that come up at all?
I actually don't know.
I'm just asking. I'm just curious.
I don't know if the question
was... Because I worry, CJ.
I don't know if the question was put in that specific way.
I'll help you next time.
But I can dive into the crosstabs and get back to it.
Great.
But I do think it's fascinating that 75% of the state says that middle class tax rates are a problem.
Well, and it's interesting because it's... That middle rate, yes. So there's a tax thing there, but there's also in the whose problem does it become to solve some of the other things that they're listing as problems, as drugs and addiction, cost of health care, cost of child care, access to child care. So as far as like if it's the government's responsibility to start fixing these things and it takes money to do that, where does that money come from? Some of it comes from taxes. So some of it is like it's wonky, it's policy, but it's also like, and I guess that becomes now the actual debate of like, what are the policies that if the end goal is to help this thing, that thing, and the other, let's debate about how we get there. But it also just feels like right now, is this the debate that you feel like is happening in Madison?
Well, before we get into that, they also asked about trust in government, trust in state government, not trust in federal government, which no one has, but trust in state government. And 18% of Wisconsin voters trust state government.
Wow.
18%. That's compared to this poll is done across the country. Across the country, it's 29%. So there is something amiss here when Wisconsin voters have less trust in their state government than other states in their state government. And I think it's because of what you just said. You look at all these problems that, again, these are issues that are getting 70% or more of Wisconsin voters say that these things are a problem. Mental health, child care, middle class tax rates. And there is a sense that this isn't the debate that's been happening. Maybe there's a sense of this isn't the stuff that's discussed or debated on the campaign trail. We just got off of, a very, to put it mildly, a very aggressive gubernatorial race. Maybe there was a sense that these things weren't really debated, fair or unfair. A lot of the times it's hard to get through because to some extent I would say maybe this stuff isn't really reported on in the media as much as it should be.
And that was part of the question that I was like, where do we, at least on this show and this network, like, what do we choose to talk about that is actually a problem versus being salacious and riles people up? Because that's, and those are sometimes the easy things to talk about because, I'm going to get callers on this one, versus something that's actually substantial and like is a problem. And one question, did they ask how much they trust local government?
I don't believe so.
Because that would be interesting to see if there is a gap between how much people in Wisconsin trust their mayors and city council and people that are in their community versus how much they trust the legislature, the governor, and what's happening in Madison.
Across the board, there was less trust. One of the findings was across the board. When you loop in like trust in federal government, it's also lower in Wisconsin than in other states. But I think, but again, to me, some of that makes sense. I mean, we've been, in our travels across the state, people are hurting. And, this comes up in a number of ways, right? Is it the Obama voter? Is this the Trump voter? Is it the Obama-Trump voter that's out there? The Biden voter, right? There's people who, this is why the pendulum keeps swinging in Wisconsin, because we have these massive issues that really haven't gotten fixed.
Well, Next time you're back, we'll take one of them and talk about how do we fix this one, because half hour segments only allow for so much time. CJ Safer, as always, lovely to have you
here.
Happy Friday. Thank you. Happy Friday. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you.
All right, taking a break for the top of the hour news, and when we come back, we're going to be talking about Milwaukee Diaper Mission and W Girls. This is As Goes Wisconsin.
Thank you for listening to As Goes Wisconsin, available on Spotify, Apple, Google, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Please subscribe and leave us a rating. As Goes Wisconsin is a product of Civic Media and airs live across Wisconsin Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Civic Media is a statewide network of radio stations broadcasting local news, local sports, thoughtful commentary, and hand-picked music. We are always streaming on the Civic Media app. Find out where you can listen on the air or learn more about Civic Media and sponsorship opportunities by going to our website, civicmedia.us. We thank you for listening.